Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 20, Interview with Eagle Ellis. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that makes you want a toddling, springa, and really gives you fart.
I can't use fart.
Yes, I can. I can do whatever I want. I am the co-host of this show.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, okay. So we have some unique words today. Can you give those words to us again?
Now, tell them that you turned the recorder off.
I did.
That was really unfair because you did not get the full...
Okay.
Go on,
Tim. Let's give me the words again.
Makes you want a toddling, springa, and gives you fart.
I don't even know where to go with this one. Well, it probably has to do with our interview with Eagle Ellis and the fact that he is from another country, and so we could probably be using his language, which is probably the key, but what are the words?
Ah, okay. Well, that's a good question, isn't it? Well.
Yeah, it's a good question. Okay.
Well, I on the... Sly used our other email so Tim would not receive the email. Emailed Helen Lundberg, who is Eagle Ellis's wife and also a racer, and asked her for some different Swedish words that had to do. So springa actually means run, tavlink actually means race, and the word fart actually means speed. So what I really says is this is the podcast that gives you speed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's great. That's good. So I'm going to go. I can't even say it to go fast somewhere. Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Well, welcome, everybody. We have not done a podcast for about a month, but we really are getting back into the spirit of it and having a great time. Had a great time this last couple of months getting ready for this winter and doing our fall training. Had a wonderful time up at the Lance Mackey event, which was at the
Full Moon Fall Fling.
Yeah. Thank you, Sherry and Russ Sotheby. Put on a wonderful event. Brought Lance and Tanya Mackey in. And they not only shared some great ideas, but just some fantastic stories. We really appreciate all the effort that they put through to get us going, and I know they've got a big event going for next year. So we'll have links in the show notes for Sherry's webpage so you can go out and see who she's got planned for next year.
Good. Good job, Sherry. Good job, Russ. Thanks again.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, before I get into who we're interviewing, we're going to do something a little bit different at the end of our show. We are going to do a few kennel tips from various mushers.
Yeah, it was a great time. When we were at the Lance Mackey event, it was... kind of nice because it was the first time in a while that we've had the chance to interview folks face-to-face or in person. And so with that, we walked around the event and asked people for kennel tips, and we got a lot of neat little ideas.
Yep.
So we're going to share those kennel tips at the end. So thank you all those that participated. And we're also, in the future, probably the next couple weeks or so, once we get done the editing, we'll probably share some of the Lance stories and different things that he had shared with us. We did record quite a bit, and we'll share some of those ideas with everybody out there listening.
Great. Well, let's move on. I wanted to tell you a little bit today about Eagle. Just a lot of our listeners really focus in on the Iditarod, but we decided to go to some sprint mushers out there, and Eagle has won the Triple Crown 4 times. Can you tell me what the Triple Crown is, Mr. Dewey?
That is the Ferrandi.
Yep.
I think it's the Onek and the Tok, right? That's
good
the Triple
job.
Crown for sprint.
Yep. Well, he's done that 3 times, winning all 3. He has also done something spectacular this year as well, because he has won the Onek, the Open North American, the 8th time, which ties George Atla. So
wow, that's amazing.
This year, if he wins it, he will have broken the record of winning the Onek.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. Now, Eagle Ellis is a successful breeder of the original Pointer Cross line of sled dogs. Now, I should say Helen and Eagle. Eagle's married to Helen Lundberg, who is also a race musher. However, Eagle generally gets the A team and Helen gets the B team.
We always seem to go the other way around. How can you always get the A team?
I don't know. Maybe because I can run faster than you.
I don't think... Okay, here we go. I think the gauntlet's down, guys. We will be having a race this weekend. So,
anyway, you can find most of their dogs, their lines, and a lot of the top sprint teams in all over the world. So it's kind of cool. So we really enjoyed interviewing him. We didn't get to actually talk to Helen, but we got to learn about Helen during the interview, and I was able to talk to her, of course, and learn my new Swedish words. But also, we just wanted to point out, if you've never gotten a hold of Dog and Driver magazine, Helen Lundberg is the editor of the ISDRAS or ISDRA's magazine, Dog and Driver. So go out there and grab it.
Very cool. Hey, let's practice those words real quick. No, I'm just
you
kidding.
Do it.
No, thanks. I'm going to pass on that. I have a hard time saying that last one. You know, I just...
Fart.
Is that with a V?
Like fart.
Like F-A?
Yeah, exactly the way it is.
It's a...
Why are you having such a problem with this word?
Well, it's just because
it's personal,
means
isn't it?
It's very personal. I apologize, guys,
mean
for this.
Speed.
There you go. Okay,
all right,
good
it's
stuff.
In the Swedish light of things.
You know, one of the reasons why I like this interview so much is that Eagle is a very, you know, I'm going to say this without hopefully embarrassing him, but he was very soft-spoken, and as we were talking to them, you could quietly hear the a dog in the background, and we asked him what he was doing, and as he was talking to us, there was a puppy in his lap, and you could just hear that puppy, and it's just, I think we just, I don't know, just endeared us to him that much more.
That's cool.
So it's very cool. So thank you so much, Eagle.
Yep, and that's about it. I think we should just get on with our interview.
Yeah, don't forget that you can go out to the website at www.sleddogpodcast.com, and on the right-hand side, if you could use that Amazon link to make any purchases, we'd greatly appreciate it. It helps us pay for the webpage and the hosting. It's not a lot per month, and we usually make about $5 a month, so it just about covers the hosting every month. So, which is good. So they don't add anything more onto your purchase price, but we get a couple percentage points of whatever you purchase. So if you're going to buy a book, or what did we buy recently? We got a pressure cooker and some other stuff.
Pressure cooker. Yep.
All kinds of fun things. So small purchases all the way up to big purchases, you can purchase them through there, and we get a little bit of kickback. So thank you so much. Also,
I guess we're not ready to go to the interview.
No, not really.
Whoops.
If you possibly could share our webpage with your friends, maybe send it to some other people and get some links, we'd greatly appreciate it. I think because of the numbers, that's how I get my motivation. So, I don't know. If more people are listening, I guess I, you know, we've got some numbers. We've had quite, what, like 10,000, 15,000 downloads. So, we appreciate all the numbers. We just need some... more. I guess it's our ego. I don't know what it is. Anyways, let's go on to the interview.
Really? Or are you going to add a few more lines in?
Well, I could talk about... No, let's go on to the interview.
Okay. Here we go.
Well, I guess to start off, Eagle, why don't you just tell us, how did you start into dog sledding? What year was it? Or I guess, was it from your childhood? Because you've been doing it for such a long time. So tell us about how you got into it.
Well, I got into it when I was 12 years old. My dad introduced dogs to us, to me and my brother. We got a Christmas of 1982, we got ourselves a Siberian Husky puppy. Maybe I should back up a little bit. It started earlier, for my dad was one of the first people in Scandinavia to actually run dogs. Him and his brother, there was a couple of other guys that ran dogs as a way of touring in the mountains. And this was in the 40s, so that's how he got into it. And he quit for many years, and after family spent 2 years in Canada, in British Columbia, he stumbled upon a sled dog kennel there and sort of got interested in it again. And so when we moved back to Sweden in 1982, he thought that, you know, it would be a fun thing to have a couple of sled dogs to, you know, for me and my brother to play around with, and kind of wanted to try it out himself again, you know. So we got our husky puppy each and started to play around with the dogs. We went on skis with them, and we built our own little sled. Eventually we went to a couple of races and joined the sled dog club in Sweden and got more and more involved. And we bought some more dogs and had a litter of pups, and eventually just started snowballing, you know, and got bigger.
So this was all the way through school and so forth? You were doing it?
Yeah, I was 12 years old then. So yeah, I got really hooked on it early. The first few years there, me and my brother, we took turns running the what we call the A team, the B team. We had six dogs, and we split them up in two teams, you know, because back then you'd race in three, five, and seven dog class. So we raced the three dog class. We had six dogs altogether. So every other race, we got the best team. You know, I got the best team, and then the next race, my brother did. So that was fun, and we did pretty good. We won a few races and ended up last in some. And after a few years there, my brother went to Montana for 1 year to go to school, and he stayed with a family there that had sled dogs. So he kind of went to school and helped this guy with the sled dogs at the same time. And he went racing a lot in the winter, and I think he got too much of it, you know, so he came back, basically didn't want to look at a dog anymore. And I didn't mind that, of course, because then I got all the dogs for myself.
That was kind of my next question. So brother didn't hang long, huh?
Yeah, he's not...
No, I think he got too much involved, and maybe he didn't have the real interest in it to begin with, but he was happy to give it all off to me, and he went, you know, he took up downhill skiing, and both him and me, we were, you know, more or less raised on skis, both downhill and cross country, and so he went back to skiing and going with the dogs.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, was the country, you said that they didn't have a lot of it when you were growing up, but they did have a club? So
yeah, when I grew up and when we started, the sport was, you know, fairly big in Scandinavia. It was back in the 40s when my dad started in sled dog. That's when it was, you know, no one had ever heard of it. So, but when I got going, there were several clubs in Sweden, and like a national federation, and there was like a Siberian Husky Club of Sweden. So I guess, you know, it's like a lot of people, you start out with Siberians because they're people that, you know, what people usually get introduced to.
Right.
When it comes to sled dogs. So we stuck to Siberians. Let's see, I raced my last Siberian team in 1989. Oh. To then, I mean, I won a lot of races against mixed breed dogs, and I did really good there with my Siberian team. It was a good, nice line of Siberians, you know, a racing type of Siberian that were really nice, actually.
So you changed probably over the time, and you've kind of migrated to the dogs you have now. What do you look for in the dogs that you're using now, and what kind of dogs are they?
When I quit my Siberian, first couple of years there, I tried to mix in, you know, a few Alaskans. I had a few pointer crosses, and you know, I picked up a few dogs here and there to try to go faster, which I thought would be very easy once I just got rid of the Siberians and got into the crossbreeds and Alaskans. I thought that was the key to success, to immediate success, and it wasn't. It was, I actually left a really nice Siberian team and went from being at the top to having a pretty hard couple of years there, struggling with results. And looking back at it, it seems like I, even though the Siberians I had weren't super fast, but they were still a team, you know, they were a uniform group of dogs that worked well together. And when I put these other dogs in, the crossbreeds and other huskies, it kind of, you know, split that group. I might have gone faster, you know, now and then, but all in all, I think that Siberian team probably better than the new team I had going, you know, for a few years.
Hmm. Well, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's not all, you know, winning team consists of a whole bunch of individuals that are working together and not two or three really good dogs, and then you pack on some more. You've got to have the uniform team, and I realized that after a while. Oh, let's see. 91, I met my wife Helen, and we had raced each other for a few years with mostly in the six dog class, and we decided to team up and go at it together. So we had about 24 dogs each. We sold half of both our dogs and put the best 24 together, and that's where the pointers came into my life. Because Helen had mostly English pointers and German pointers, and I still had mostly the husky type of dog.
Now, looking back in Sweden and the climate and the different dogs and the different people running in Sweden, is it a lot different than what you see in America today?
No, it's very similar. The climate is pretty much what we have here in Alaska, and no, it's very, very similar.
And the type of races that you ran back in Alaska, is it the same kind of racing that you're doing with the Open North American and the Fur Randy?
No. The sport is older here, of course, and it has more longer tradition, and especially the open class racing has a lot longer tradition and a whole different level than it has in Europe. And that's one of the reasons why we moved over here, when we decided to, you know, go all out in the open class. There's not much to do in Europe as far as the open class racing.
Oh, okay.
But other than that, it's really similar. I think the races are really professionally put on in Europe, and they have a lot of sponsors and a lot of media, a lot of spectators. And the only thing they don't have is purse money. You know, some of the bigger races have some money to race for, but most of the races are just trophies and glory.
Yeah. Okay.
You can't really make a living of it racing over there.
Okay. Great. All right. So you decided to come to America.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to decide that?
Well, it was a long, long time dream. Both me and Helen have had. You know, we started out reading all the books we could find about dog mushing, and everything we read, you know, kind of went back to Alaska or to the States where the sport was bigger back when we started. And so Alaska kind of always kind of a dream for us, I guess, and especially the big races like the Rendezvous and Open North American and Limited North American also. You know, those are races we've read about for a long time, and we've seen videos about it. And so that was kind of the long, long-term goal back when we started. And I raced every winter since 1985. So I guess since then, Alaska has the main goal for us. Even if it took all the time till 98 before we actually made it over here with our own team to race. You know, so it took a lot of years of planning and dreaming, I guess, and getting everything together, get the team together, get sponsors together, and get enough money together to come over here the first time.
So did you ever run a race here before you moved?
Yeah, first we came over in, we went here in 1997.
Okay.
And just we flew over to just look at the North American race and the race of champions in Tok. So we just went over without dogs to look everything over and meet people and see the race, and as a preparation for the next year in 98 when we were supposed to come over with our own team and race.
Right.
So in 98 was the first year we came over. We came here about 2 weeks or so before the North American, Open North American. I think we just raced, we didn't do the Limited. We just did the Open North American that year and the race in Tok. So that was the first
year. How'd you fare in that race? I don't remember seeing your results in that race, so.
Yeah, no, that was a guy ended up fifth at the
okay.
Open North American.
I mean, I know you did well in 99.
Yeah.
And then you kept on going.
From 99 on,
I
knew more what to do. So I ended up fifth in Open North American. I actually won in Tok the weekend after. And since then, I've won.
You're on your eighth time. So
every year except one, I think, since 98. So.
Wow. So what did you need to learn how to do? You said I had to figure some things out or...
Yeah, no, the first year there, we thought we knew what we were doing, and we brought a good team to the line, we thought. I hooked up 20 dogs, and I think I loaded one or two dogs every day, and I ended up running only 7 dogs the last day of the 98.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And that last day was actually the best day of those three. So I would have probably done a lot better just hooking up maybe 10 dogs the first day, but you know, I didn't know really what to expect, and I didn't know how the team was going to react, you know, on these really hard, fast trails. You know, we came from Sweden with different training than what we do now. We trained smaller teams and not as fast and softer trails, and they weren't used to just running on hard trails. They were used to actually working and getting along at a slower pace on softer trails. So when they hit the rock hard trails here in Alaska, and I let up on the brake and try to go fast, they just, you know, they lost their balance basically, and just they couldn't handle it.
Hmm.
So I think they would have done better with maybe another week or so on with training up here for the race. We were afraid of getting the dogs sick, you know, coming
sure.
from Scandinavia, so we tried to get in as late as possible, basically, for the race.
Well, that makes sense.
But then we trained after the North American, we trained a few more times, and the dogs sort of learned what to do, and I saw, you know, which dogs to take out too, and I put a better team together for the weekend after and did really good at the Tolk race. We learned.
Of course. Now, when did you decide that you were going to be more in the open class sprint racing, or do you still have a dream to go longer like the Iditarod, or...
Yeah, well, I started out in the three-dog class, as I said before, and worked my way up. I can't remember, it was some late 80s, I think they changed everything to four, six, and eight-dog, so I worked my way up there to in an open class. I'd race maybe around 80, 88, 89, I think my first open race was. And that wasn't really open either. That was in Sweden back then. It was an open team then was maybe a 10 or 12 dog team. It was all considered open, you know, anything more than eight. But pretty much since then, since late 80s, I've run in open classes, or we've had that as the main goal at least, and what we train for. If we don't have enough dogs for two open teams at a race, we might run two 8-dog teams and or one 8-dog and one open, or, you know, get all the dogs out. But the main goal is for our kennel is still the open class sprint races.
So you run a lot of the different races. Which race do you like the best? And tell us a little bit about, I know you do the Ferrandi and some others. I mean, do you like the ones that are out in the wilderness? Do you like going through the cities? I mean, what do you like the most about running, and which ones are the, I guess, the most fun?
Yeah, well, our main races that we like the most and what we focus on are the Open North American in Fairbanks and the Open World Championship in Anchorage, the Ferrandi race. They're both, you know, long open class races, and they're tough on the dogs, and they're hard to run, hard to race. I guess that's what makes them challenging, you know, and why we keep coming back. It's kind of the way for us to evaluate our dogs at an optimum level and to really see what they're good for. We know they're fast enough, but, you know, can they maintain that speed at the longer distances, at 20, 30 miles? I guess that's what's so intriguing about it.
So how many dogs do you have now currently?
I have about 70 adults. And right now we have 16 pups.
Fantastic. And now Helen's still running too, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We start out in the fall with about 45 dogs for the race team. And by race time, we usually have 35 to 40 dogs that can go on the truck with us. And yeah, so we try to run, run as many dogs as possible, basically, at a race. I usually run the main open team, and then Helen fills in with the yearlings, either in a smaller open team or in the 8-dog class.
Well, you know, that's my next question. I was asking who gets the B team and who gets the A team.
Right now, it's the last few years I've been racing the main team, which is in the open class all the time, and I might in the early season bring in a few yearlings on, you know, like some of the best yearlings on my team to look them over and see how they look together with the older dogs, just to see if any of them are able to make it on the main races, you know, later in the season. Usually December, January are the races we do then is either with only or, you know, try to bring in all the yearlings or mix them in with the older dogs, you know, teach them to go at race speeds and a good way for us to look them over too.
We've got to ask, Eagle, is that a puppy or a big dog there?
Yeah, no, it's one of our house dogs that's curled up in my lap here. He growls at another dog that walks by now and then because he wants to keep his territory here.
That's great. That is great.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't think that anybody's ever really explained the Open North American Champion race. Could you just, like, tell us about that race for the open class, like the miles and the terrain?
Oh, okay. It's a three-day race. You run 20 miles, or to be exact, I think it's 19.8 miles Friday, Saturday. And on Sunday, it's 28 miles. And it starts on 2nd Avenue in downtown Fairbanks. And you run out the first a half mile is on the street, and then you drop down onto the Chena River, and you run on the Chena River for half a mile, and then you go into a slough. Takes you another maybe 2 miles along a fairly winding narrow slough. You cross over College Road, and after that first road crossing, the trail splits. If you're going out, you take a right, and then you do a big loop onto the ADMA race trail, and then you come back and do the College Road crossing again, and you drop down into the slough, same slough that you came out on. First, what is it, 3 miles is first and last 3 miles, it's the same trail.
Okay.
Yeah. When we have a big starting field, I think it's more, if we have more than 20 teams or so, we can have head-on passes on the way home. Or if you, on the way out, if you start out late, which makes for some pretty exciting things sometimes. The first day when people run big teams, you know, 20, 22, 24 dogs, and you have to meet other teams head-on, that's pretty exciting.
Are you just flying? How fast are you going at this point?
The first 2 days there, when we do 20 miles, we do that under an hour, 58, 59 minutes. So we average over 20 miles an hour.
Holy cow.
The first 2 days. And then for the longer distance there, the third day, we're probably doing around 19, 19 and a half maybe, depending on the trail. You know, if it's cold and really hard, fast trail like it usually is, we can sometimes go faster than that too. But I race in anything from 45 degree temperatures and, you know, 20 below. So it's, you know, you can have a lot of variables with the weather. But that first year in 98, that was record warm. And, I mean, people were walking around in T-shirts and shorts and body boots. It was warm. It was 45, 48 even. And that year they couldn't do the downtown start because the water, there was so much water on the slough and the river that we had to start up on the at the clubhouse instead.
Wow.
Now, why do you think you've been so successful in this race?
Well, I guess I've done the right things, right choices, right training, you know. And what makes you successful in something? I guess it's just, if you keep at it long enough, you know, and you have some kind of talent doing it, eventually success will come. Yeah, like anything else, you know, if you keep at it long enough, you hopefully get good at it. And it's something I've had in mind, in my back of my head for so long, and I've studied the race, I've read all about it, and we've tried out a lot of different things, a lot of different ways to do things, and we've been fortunate to have good dogs and good line of dogs that good decisions, I guess, with breeding and training, and, you know, worked hard at it for many years.
Oh, for sure. Did you think about 10 years ago that you'd be tying George Atla's record and hopefully breaking it this year?
No. 10 years ago, I mean, the first year when we came here, I thought fifth place was really good for the first year. Even though I knew if I had done some smarter choices and decisions, I would have done a lot better. And I guess that's why we got, you know, inspired to come back and try it again, because we knew our dogs could do better than that. And we found that out the years after. But if someone would have told me I would tie George in 10 years, I wouldn't have believed it. You know, it's like the first year in 99 when we raced the Fur Rendezvous. And we had a lot more respect for the Rondi than we did for the North American, for some reason. I don't know. We just thought the Rondi was tougher. And I still think, in a way, that the Rondi is a harder race to win. But anyway, we had more respect for the Rondi. So we started racing there in 99. And then we said that if we can win this race in maybe 5-6 years or you know, top five, or that we would be really happy. And then it turns out we won the race the first year by, I don't know how many minutes, 5-6 minutes, I think. So that was a big surprise to us then.
Wow.
But it's still a hard race. I won it 4 times, and that's a hard race to figure out.
Do you see your competitors having changed a lot since you've gotten to Alaska, or is it pretty much the same?
Yeah, for sure. The competition is a lot different now, I think. And the main reason, I think, is because of the different dogs. When we got here in 99 or 98, we were pretty much alone with these pointer crosses that we have now, everyone has now. So that was a big advantage for us. And we might have been, you know, down on experience a little bit, but I think we had better dogs to start out with that those first few years. When that combined with more experience from our side, you know, that's when we started winning every race we entered for, you know, 4 or 5, 6 years. And eventually the other competitors, they bred to our dogs and they bought dogs from us. And, you know, we had to make a living and pay the cost to come over here and race. So we couldn't, you know, keep the dogs for ourselves. We had to sell some dogs and sell breedings. And now, you know, 10, 12 years later, I don't think you can find any other top team that does have our bloodlines somewhere in their dogs.
Yeah. That's amazing. So what's your competitive advantage for the future? Are you finding new dogs from around the world to breed them in? No, I'm just kidding.
we're always looking at other dogs, other teams, and we're, you know, whenever there's a new kind of dog coming out, we look at it closely. If it's something we like, you know, if it's something we think that could improve our dogs or improve our kennel. So far, we haven't really... I mean, there are a lot of other good dogs, other bloodlines that are very good and would, you know, probably make it on my main team. But it has to be a dog that we like, you know, in all ways. You know, like, you know, the attitude of the dog, the look of the dog, the way it's built, the way it's running. And so we're really picky about choosing other dogs from other bloodlines to breed with, and we have to start looking around for other bloodlines to breed into our dogs. The dogs we have now, they're, you know, more or less related, every single, you know, you can only do that for so long.
The dogs you brought over, and I guess you brought them over from Sweden, are they still, you know, are the bloodlines back home in Sweden, are they similar now, or have you guys kind of, I don't want to say evolved into something else, but modified into something else?
Yeah, no, the dogs we brought over, we still sell dogs to Scandinavia and to Europe, and we have sold so many dogs now the last, you know, whatever it is, 12, 15 years, that if you're just after the bloodline, you can get it pretty much anywhere now. And there's a lot of our bloodlines still in Scandinavia, but I'm sure there's, you know, there are other pointer lines for sure now that are doing really good in Scandinavia, and I think, you know, in Europe too, there's other breeds of dogs showing up. I'm sure one day someone will come up with something better, you know, that's just the way it is.
We'll get faster.
We think we're going really fast now, and that we've sort of, people say that we've reach the limits of what a dog can do, but I don't think that. We probably won't make, you know, any huge leaps like we did when we started to come over here and race, but the teams will slowly but surely get faster and faster, you know. Before we shaved off minutes of the track records, but now we do it second by second.
It's an amazingly fast game now, so I can't imagine it getting faster. Yeah. What other things are you interested in, Eagle? What other things fill up your time, or is it 24 hours a day about dogs?
Oh, yeah. What is it? it's pretty much dogs. No, I do. I mean, I train myself. I do some mountain biking, and I do some cross-country running, even though I do it with the pups mostly. So that's kind of with the dogs, too.
Still ski?
Yeah, that's not as much, not at all as much as I used to. I used to race in both downhill and cross country when I was a kid. And now it's, you know, it's maybe once a year. We try, after the season, we try to go down to ski area here and have a few days of skiing.
Now, but, have you tried ski touring? You have to have had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did a lot of that when I was a kid, when we started with the dogs. Ski tour with, you know, two or three or four dogs even. We played around with ski-joring with downhill skis and with cross-country skis, and we hooked up dogs to these little plastic pulkas, you know, that the kids right. used to go in, and we had all kinds of vehicles to sit on and lay on, and
right.
and we've tried body surfing and all kinds of stuff with the dogs, so we had a lot of fun, me and my brother, when we started out. We built our own sleds that we, because we lived high up in the mountains, high up like above the tree line, out on the tundra basically. So we had these wide open spaces where we could run around on, and we built really heavy-duty sleds that we used in the summer and fall and just hooked up the dogs and took off out on the swamps with them. We ran behind it and that kind of way. But it's a little more sophisticated now.
Yeah, maybe a little safer, I guess.
yeah, for sure.
You're still alive. That's good.
Yeah, I am. Now, I learned a lot, though. You learn a lot by playing around like that. You know, you get good balance. You learn how to handle yourself in a lot of different situations. So.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Do you have any other family that moved over also, or do you go back and see the family back home?
We don't have any family over here. We've got a lot of Swedish friends around here, and Norwegians and other Scandinavians, but families, they're all back in Sweden.
Do they think you're crazy for doing what you're doing, or are they, you know?
No, they're used to it. They probably don't remember anything else, me doing anything else, you know, since I've done it since I was 12 years old, so they're used to it by now. Some of them probably thought we were a little crazy when we wanted to move here. We traveled back and forth the first 4 years, from 98 to 2001. We flew back and forth with 40 dogs. And
wow.
Raised here for 2 months at a time. So that's how we started coming over here. They had Lufthansa Cargo had a really good flight. It was a direct flight from Frankfurt to Fairbanks. It was only an 8-hour flight. So that's how we traveled over the first few years. And now they've stopped that flight, so that makes it a lot harder for European teams to come over and race.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me about the season for you. Like right now, what are you working on right now? Are you out training the dogs right now?
Or? Yeah, right now we're doing like light exercise training on the walker. We have one of these big wheels or walkers where you hook the dogs up to their collars and they walk around in a big circle. And it's a kind of a exercise thing or first. The initial fall training we do to get them back in good shape after the summer. So that's what we do now. We started that usually around beginning or mid-July, and we do that till mid or end of October when we start hooking them up in teams.
And then do you use a quad and just head out and go for small runs and then bigger runs, or what do you do?
Yeah, what they do now on the walker right now, they're doing about 70-minute workouts on that. And they do 35 minutes each direction. And I'll increase that slowly now to do about, 45, 50 minutes each direction. And that's later in the end of September, beginning of October. And I usually get about 350 to 400 miles of the walking into them before we start hooking them. And we usually start the team training in around the 15th or 20th of October. And we start out with smaller teams, usually 10 dog teams, 12 dog teams. Since they've been on the walker and they're all in good shape, they're all well muscled up, and they're ready for a little heavier training. We can start out at a longer distance and a little higher speed than I think most other teams start out. So start out at about the first few runs are only maybe 4 miles. Just to get them back in the routine of the team and give the yearlings a kind of a slower start there the first few runs. But after that, we can increase the mileage fairly steep, since they are in good shape.
Hmm.
Yeah, and just work our way up from there. Last year, we had a good, nice fall here. It was pretty cool and clear weather, and the first snowfall came really early, so we had only 2 runs on gravel before we started running on snow. We were still running with the four-wheeler, though, but we had, 3-4 inches of snow cover, and that was really good for feed. We didn't have any feed problems at all last year.
That's great. And then what's the first race you run?
Usually we have, by mid-December or so, we have the first smaller races at our club here in the Montana Creek Dog Mushers. The other clubs around here, they have some smaller, more like training races that we go to get the yearlings out and start evaluating them in a race situation. And then by mid-January beginning of January, we usually have the Sioux Valley Championship, which is just a bigger race. Yeah, from beginning or mid-January on to end of March, we have the more important races, and we can probably race every weekend if we wanted to.
Wonderful. Now, do either one of you work outside of the house or outside of the dogs, or are you just full-time at this?
Yeah, we've been doing this full-time now for the last, say, 10, 12 years. When we lived in Sweden, we used to, my wife worked at a newspaper. She was an editor for the local newspaper, and she worked from, like, after the race season to around October, November. She worked full-time as an editor, and then I had different jobs going to in the summertime. And then since we moved over here, we've been into dogs pretty much full-time. Helen still does the journalism work from home, some freelancing jobs, and she's the editor for for the Istra magazine now, the Dog and Driver, and she writes articles, you know, for other magazines and stuff like that. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so for the summertime, do you guys get to get away, or do you have handlers at all that come in and help? Or
usually we don't have handlers in the summer. Our handlers come in around November, December, stay with us over the race season. We we prefer to do as much of the work ourselves in the kennel. And yeah, we try to get away a little bit in the summer whenever we can. If not for longer, we try to get out and do day trips or whatever we can to kind of get away from the dogs now and then. It's pretty nice.
Well, and you know, I guess, you know, I always ask a lot of the mushers this question. I don't know where it comes from, but what drives your competitive spirit to win? I mean, a lot of people like to run dogs just to run them and have a great time and that kind of stuff, but you seem like you want to win. Where did that drive come from?
I think that's something you just have to have within you somehow, you know. That's, some people are more competitive, some are less. When I started running dogs, I was probably more competitive than I mean, I wanted to win every little local race there was, and, you know, it was more important to win then. And it's still important to win, but it takes a bigger event, a bigger race for me to, you know, to sort of fire on all the cylinders, you know, nowadays. Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably good in a way, because I've learned to, you know, choose the important races and not pushing the dogs early in the season, or, you know, not getting stressed out if I don't win those first initial races of the season, or if the team maybe doesn't look good in the early season. I'm confident enough now that I know that, you know, they'll eventually come around and start doing better for the main races. I think it's just, you know, your personality. For some people it's important to win, for others not. And for us also, it's important to win to sort of promote our kennel, our dogs. Since we make a living out of it, it's important for us to win, or at least do good in races, to show that our dogs are the best or top of the heap.
When you won the North Open North American,
the ONAC?
Say the wrong thing. So, in the ONAC, when you won it the eighth time, I mean, did you still have that huge competitive drive going, or did you just kind of whistle through and win in this race again, or how did that?
No. When it comes around to in time for the Rondi and the North American, you know, I always, both me and Helen, we get sort of wound up and we get a little tighter, and we get really focused on what we have to do, and yeah, we get really competitive then.
Because you don't want to lose your edge, you want to win. Okay.
Yeah,
and even though you've won now, 8 times.
Yeah, no, I mean, I won it nine times or 10 times. You know, nowadays it's even more important that we really focus on what we have to do, because the competition is there. We really have to want to win it now to be able to do it, because it's really tough. And I guess those first few years there, I could win it and be fairly relaxed about doing it. I could mess up one day and make up for it the next day, or I could load a dog here and there, or I could even stop the team and, you know, run up and do something, or switch dogs around. I could still win the day's heat by a minute or two. But nowadays, if you have one stop, or if you have a dog get its foot over the line, or you have to switch a dog around, or load a dog, or, you know, you have a bad pass or something like that, which
could
was a minor problem before, that could, you know, drop you one or two places now. So if you want to win now, you have to be really on your toes and extremely competitive.
okay, we always get to this point and ask, is there any great stories that you like to tell your friends or people that you might meet? Any crazy adventures you had on the trail or anything that you talk about usually?
I guess one of the classic ones are the, I can't remember which year it was on the North American. I think it was the 2000 race. Someone had gone out, this was the first day, and someone had changed the block, the fence that blocks the trails, you know. The first 2 days we do the 20-mile loop, and then on the third day we go out, and before we turn home, we, instead of taking a left, we take a right and go out on what's called the extension loop, a 7-mile extension. And this year someone had been, you know, I don't know, they wanted to disrupt the race or whatever they wanted. They said it might have been some drunk or, you know, crazy snow machine or whatever. Someone had gone out and moved the blocks, the trail blocks. So when the first team came by there, and I think the first 3-4 teams were all rookies, you know. So they weren't, I mean, they had been around the trail, but they weren't 100% sure of exactly where the trail used to go every year. So when they came around there, they automatically, instead of taking a left, they took a right and went into that extension because it was blocked. It looked like it was the right trail to go on. So that was a pretty eventful year. And they actually ended up cutting out that whole first day because so many teams went wrong. And I went in there too, and went in there for maybe a mile or so. Even though I had raced, you know, the race a few times before that, I came up on this, and the trail block looked perfectly fine, and you sort of come around a corner, and you're traveling down the trail at a fast speed, and you see all the other tracks go into here, and at the second I made that turn, I thought, oh no, is this right? I mean, shouldn't we have gone straight there? You know, you don't have a lot of time to think about this, but when you're traveling, I had probably I had 18 dogs. And I just, you know, I went in there myself and went in for about a mile, mile and a half. And at the same time, we had the radio coverage, you know, you hear the checkpoint times, and they also had a helicopter that year that was, you know, relating where the teams were and stuff like that. So as soon as I turned into this extension, I started hearing on the radio that, you know, there was something wrong. There are teams on the extension trails, and, you know, we shouldn't be doing this trail today, and this is the last day's trail and all this.
Huh.
So I realized, you know, something was wrong. This is not right. And also that year, I had a lot of yearlings on the team that I hadn't planned on running the last day on that long distance. You know, I planned for them to be in the team for the first and maybe the second day, but definitely not the last day. So I decided that I got to do something here. I got to turn the whole team around and go back to where the trail split. So I went in for a mile or a mile and a half I got to the first straightaway, because the trail is fairly windy there for the first miles on the extension, and straight trail to be able to turn 18 dogs around, you know, and it's only like a 6-7 foot trail. So I stopped the team, I slammed my hook down, I ran up and grabbed the leaders and just swung the leaders around. So I sort of had them swung the leaders. So I was kind of in between. I had dog pairs on both sides of me, and I grabbed the leaders and I just ran as fast as I could back to the sled. And I looked back while I did it, and I could see that, you know, pair after pair of dogs, they just turned around and started coming back. And as I'm back to the sled was still pointing in the other direction. I let go of my leaders. I told them to keep going, and the rest of the team followed. And I threw myself over and grabbed the sled, turned the sled around. I got the hook out, and off we went. Not a single tangle.
Did you have like 10 head-ons then immediately?
No, I had, and while all this was happening, I could hear on the radio that there were other teams turning into the extension as well. So I knew there were other teams
coming
straight at me, you know. So I was prepared for that. And I think I had 2 head-ons on this really windy trail leading in there.
Did you tell them to turn around?
So I got to the Y in the where the trail blocking was. And luckily there was just a snow machine trail where I could ride before the trail blocking. There was a snow machine that led it onto the right trail. So I stopped the team again and went there and just threw the first two pairs of dogs over. And I ran back to the sled and told them to go and waddle over there in the deep snow and onto the right trail. And away we went. So, and by this time, they had sent someone out there to change that trail block. So I think the last few teams, they weren't affected on this at all. But I think at least half of the starting field went into the extension. So that's why they scratched that whole first day, and that was good. But so that was a pretty exciting moment.
Yeah, and, good for you.
It could have been ugly.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean I could have ended up with just a big ball of 18 dogs all tangled up, and other teams coming by, and it could have been really messy. But yeah, I had a bit of luck involved in that, that's for sure. And but I think what I did right about it was that I first of all made the decision to turn around instead of going the whole way. But I made this decision really quick, and I did it really quickly too. You know, I stopped the team as fast as I could, and I ran up there, and I was up by the leaders before any of the dogs really, you know, realized what was going on. And I didn't wait. I just took the leaders, swung them around, and I did everything really quick. So they didn't get a chance to stand there and start barking and screaming. And
right.
I made everything happen really quickly. So they were almost surprised by the whole situation, the dogs. And also this is about 8-9 miles into the race, which also helped, you know, they were a little off their initial edge there.
Yeah, I can't imagine if this was in mile 2. Probably
yeah, no.
For sure.
Yeah, no, so that was a pretty exciting moment in my mushing career. I wish they would have had a camera there on the helicopter. That would have been some pretty exciting footage.
Oh, absolutely. Did you hear them talking about you at all? Is somebody turning around?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that. The guy up on the helicopter, he wasn't really sure what was going on either, you know. And that made me, after I had turned the team around, I started thinking, oh, no, what did I do the right thing? Because the guy in the helicopter said, oh, there's one team turning around, you know. And he didn't see it was me. So, and I thought, oh, no, maybe I did, you know, maybe we should have gone in here. You know, did I miss something at the driver's meeting? Or, you know, all these thoughts ran through my head that maybe we should have done the long one today. Or is it the last day we do it? Or, you know, all these thoughts.
Tell me you didn't think you were going to turn around again.
No, I said, I'm done. I won't do this again. After I got on the right trail there and started heading back, eventually I just turned my radio off and just, you know, no, I've had enough of this for today.
Oh, exactly. Well, tell us, how does your 2009 season look?
It's looking pretty good. We've got we had quite a few yearlings last year that are still with us, and that will make the team for sure this year. They're looking really exciting, and we're looking forward to it. We've got a good group of dogs and a good setup going. So the main races will of course be the Ronde and the Open North American, and then we'll see if we can maybe do some more traveling or so.
There you go. And you sell a lot of puppies. Do you sell them just usually in the summertime, or do you sell your puppies all year round?
Usually we don't sell any pups, actually. Most of the time we keep the pups, and we train them up and teach them what to do, and you know, get their best potential out. And then we evaluate them and see which ones will fit into our team, which will go on to other teams and improve them. And you know, some dogs are better suited for maybe limited class racing, shorter distances, and some that aren't fast enough, they could do really well on a mid-distance team or a stage racing team or something like that. So that's usually how we do it. We train all the dogs and then sell them, you know, for what they're good for, and that way we make sure that there aren't any dogs that doesn't want to be a sled dog that is out there. You know, they all know what to do when they leave this yard.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That is fantastic.
Absolute favorite dogs, or do you have so many dogs that you just...
Other than the one on your lap.
Yeah. Our main leaders, you know, throughout the years, they've become special, of course. Like Mike, for example, and what else do we have? We have Lotries and Elvira, and yeah, I've had a lot of great leaders through the years, so they become special. Right now, our main leader, or that has been running main lead for years now, is TV. He's one of my all-time favorites. Tina has been a good leader too, and got some some pretty exciting younger leaders coming up as well. Ruby, he ran all the main races in Lead this year. Big, powerful dog. And some PV pups that are also up-and-coming main leaders that are... So, yeah, usually the main leaders are the ones, you know, those are the ones that you sort of have the best contact with, or you get the best contact with, and those are the ones you have to communicate with, you know, on all levels, and they become special that way. You know, you get really close to, sometimes they surprise you with doing things that you didn't tell them to do, but they just do it because you thought about doing it, you know, that way. So, yeah, the leaders are always special.
Getting on the personal side, is your father still alive?
No, he passed away about a year ago, actually. So,
But he did get to see you race or hear you race and that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. We traveled around for years. I mean, for probably the first 8 years or so, we traveled around together. And he raced himself, not the really short, fast races, but he liked to do the longer mid-distance races and stuff like that. He raced well into his almost 80s.
Wow.
Good for him.
That is wonderful.
He was very involved in it. I mean, he's the main reason why I am where I am today. You know?
Oh, that is wonderful.
It's been great learning about your kennel. It's
Thank you.
Racing. Is there any other passion or anything you want to tell us about before we head on out?
Other passions?
Any other things or any other... Whatever. You got anything else to say?
Is there other things in life?
Yeah.
Yes.
You tell me.
We got to start sending you some books or something to get your mind out of it.
Yeah. I might need some other kind of therapy going here.
Do you have a TV there? We'll have to send you a video.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about that. Yeah, there's supposed to be something called TV. Yeah. I'll try that one of these days.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for the interview.
Yeah, not a problem. Nice chatting with you.
Boy, wasn't that a great interview, Gene?
Yeah, I like it. I like the part about his dad.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's very cool. You know, I think that's such a neat experience to be able to run as a family member. I think Gene and I, you know, obviously we've got into it later in life, but as the children grow up and have experiences with their dads and then obviously can continue those on, I just really think that's neat. And moms, I shouldn't just say dads. I just think it's wonderful to see so many people involved as a family and as just caring about something together. It matters so much. It keeps the family focused.
Yep. Let's go on to our new kennel tips.
Yes, and as soon as we can catch up with Dr. Tim, we'll get some more interviews. We've got a couple of
questions
to ask him, and we might be able to see him this weekend, so hopefully we'll get a chance to see him in person.
Yeah, that's right. Great. Here we go.
Yes.
Come on, Jill.
Hi, we're here with Joan Miller, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her kennel tip.
I find that I've liked the wood decking in my kennel because my dogs like to dig, and they can't dig around it. I space it so that they can the water can drain through it. And they like to lay on the wood too, and it doesn't retain the heat like cement blocks can, and it's easy to move around if you do it in smaller sections, and that's what I found that I've liked to use in my kennel.
So do you do the whole kennel, like, I mean, as far as like their whole run in that, or just like a certain area for them to run in?
I've done just a certain area in the front, like in the entranceway, by their dog houses, the entrances to their houses. I put their houses on top of it so they can't dig under them, and then the houses collapse on top.
That's great. Now, do you womanized, or do you use just regular wood and then treat it, or do you just use wood and let them chew away and repair it later?
I've heard that you shouldn't use womanized. I'm not sure about that, but I've used just regular wood, and then I stain it and let it dry really well before I put it in there.
Awesome. Thank you, Jill. We're
tip.
Here with Sharon Love, and she's going to give us a kennel tip.
For your water bowls, use stainless steel stock pots that you can buy at Meijer's. The handles, you just slide on a pipe. They can't pull them up, and they don't rust.
Wow, we got to go back to this. So say this again. What kind of bowls
are
they?
Stainless steel stock pots, like what you would make a soup in or a stew, and they're double handled, and you can just take the handle and slide it down on a pole that you have in the ground. They slide right down, and the dogs can't lift them off.
That is such a great idea.
And they don't rust because they're not galvanized.
That is awesome. And galvanization is not good anyways.
What size stock pot? I'm using like a 2-gallon one.
Awesome. Thank you. Awesome tip. Hi, we're with Joe Osteen. And Joe's going to give us a kennel tip.
Well, it's not really a kennel tip. It's a command that I use whenever I'm running my dogs about a half mile or a mile from the finish line or the trailhead. I give them a command like take it on home or let's go or truck or one command so that they know they're almost to the end. So if you're running a strange trail, you give them that command and they will run full speed to the finish line.
Now, have you done that on races and really boost your performance?
Oh, yes. And the big command is go truck. And my lead dog will fly to the truck over the finish line.
So you better be holding on.
Yes, you got to be holding on, especially when you're doing on skis.
Yeah.
You yell, go truck.
Joe and I compete in the ski jury.
Yes,
so that's
right.
Good.
That's my secret.
So if I hear that and you're behind me, I really better get going.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hi, Brad and RJ.
Hello.
We're looking for kennel tips today. So think about one thing that you guys do in the kennel. For all the newbies that are listening, that you guys want to say, hey, make sure you do this.
Fly control has been an issue with a lot of people. A lot of people stress Tri-Tech 14, which I won't deny is not good. But I've since had the tip of BioSpot, and BioSpot's been excellent. Price started going up, and we spent enough money in the kennel as it is. I found another stuff called Zima. It's a generic BioSpot. $4, get 3 tubes. Put 1 drop on each ear, 1 drop on the head. No flies for a month.
That's awesome.
Works great.
That's fantastic.
I can't stress that enough. That will be in the works for me for a second time next year. It was a little late to get it in this year. We figured by the time people read it this year, they'd forget about it next year. But undoubtedly, the best fly controller is, in my opinion.
I hate bloody ears. That's great.
They're gone.
That is
They're
good.
Done. You don't have to worry about the dogs getting frostbitten in the wintertime because they have their fur. They look pretty.
Thank you, Brad. Love.
Hey, Brad, where would one pick that up?
We find it at Tractor Supply. I'm sure you'd find it at most tack shops as well, or even you could order it probably out of Doctors Foster and Smith. But saving the shipping and everything, and like I say, the BioSpot was got up to $12 or $14, and you can buy those by the tube. What they're designed for is flea and tick repellent, and they sell it. You buy it by the dog for poundage for the dog, and they say put the whole tube on, but we don't do it. I buy this for 66-pound and bigger dogs, and I'll take one tube, and one tube will usually do about 4 or 5 dogs. I'm just putting one drop on each one.
That's awesome.
That's great. Thanks so much, Brad. Where are you from, Brad?
Schoolcraft, Michigan.
So, Ted, can you give us a kennel tip from your kennel?
One thing I think people should know is that when it comes to clean water for a dog, how important that is, and not just the fact that they have water, but it's clean, not rainwater so much as it's clean water out of your system at your house. They should be dumped at least once to twice a day. Be filled up with clean water. Dogs appreciate it, and much more healthy for the dog.
That's great. Thanks, Ted.
Hey, Ted, what about algae and that kind of stuff? You know how some of them get green?
Yes, that's another reason why you want to change your water, because if you don't, algae does build up. You get that, and I don't know what that does to the dogs, if it harms them, but I don't think it's good for them. So by changing your water often and wiping out your buckets, it does keep the algae from building up.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
And who's this lovely lady next to you?
That's my lovely wife, Ann.
Yeah? Hi, Ann. Are you having fun today?
I'm having fun.
Okay, we're here with Melanie Packard, and she has a kennel tip.
Wooden platforms for them to actually sit on, and it gets them up off the ground. They can see things better, and when they're playing, they can run under them and around them.
What do you make them out of?
Wood.
Is it like a pallet kind of thing on the float ground, or do you put it up by the sides of the
top? They're closer together so they can't get their paws and toes caught between them. But we tried putting carpet on them to make it more comfortable, and they got rid of that real quick. So just the plain wood, and that way they can play under, around them.
Fantastic.
So how high off the ground are they?
About 2 feet.
Cool. How do you put them up there? On bricks or just...
Four wooden legs.
And fantastic. Is it regular wood or womanized?
Regular.
Awesome. And who's this guy over here? Just kidding, Rob. That's the builder. So how's it feel to be the builder and the handler?
Yeah.
Thank you, Rob.
Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody, for a great show. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Don't forget to go to www.sleddogpodcast.com and click on that Amazon link to help support the show. And or there's a donate button if you'd like to just donate.
Dog food.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Yeah, dog food. Please send dog food. Also, the...
Or we could just donate dogs to them.
Oh, yes. We have a couple of dogs. So if anybody is interested in a couple of wonderful sled dogs...
Yeah.
We don't have any, but we do have a couple that we'd like to give away.
No, they are good.
They are wonderful. They're just not super fast right now. So all is well, and we thank you, everybody. And if you ever want to get a hold of us, you can email Tim at tim@sleddogpodcast.com.
And Gina@sleddogpodcast.com.
Until next time, have a great day.
And I hope you guys have lots of fart there on the trail.
Oh, boy. I know the dogs sometimes do. Okay, have a good day. Bye, guys.